Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Back in the 1960s, when John Kennedy declared the United States would put a man on the moon, the mission was sold to the American people as a race that we could not afford to lose. Our guest in this hour, historian Gerard de Groot, says the Americans were told the moon landing would be good for the economy, it would be good for politics, it would be even be good for the soul. As it turned out, he says, it was a very expensive distraction of rather little scientific or cultural worth, something that in many ways was purely an historical accident. And a result of the Cold War tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union. Those are some of the ideas that he presents in his recent book, Dark Side of the Moon, The Magnificent Madness of the American Lunar Quest. The book is out now. It is published by the New York University Press, if you would like to read it. And he is joining us this morning by telephone to talk about the book. He is professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He himself is an American, although he has lived and taught in Britain for the last 25 years or so. He's written 10 books on various aspects of 20th century history. His most recent, The Bomb, A Life, was awarded the 2004 Westminster Medal for the best book published in the English language on a war or military topic. He is also a freelance journalist and has written op-ed articles for many papers in Britain and the United States. And he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome. We certainly would like to get people involved in the conversation. All we ask is that callers are just brief so that we can accommodate as many as possible and keep our program moving. Anyone who is listening can join the conversation by calling 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. And we do also have a toll-free line. And if it would be a long-distance call for you, you may use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. At any point, if you would like to call and join the conversation, you're welcome to do that. Professor de Groot, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Just as to a way of starting out, perhaps, I would ask you to talk a little bit about how you started on this book, because as you explain in the preface, it was not necessarily your intention at the beginning to write something negative about the space program. In fact, you explain that after having written the book that you did about nuclear weapons, you were looking for something that would be a little bit more positive and a little bit more uplifting, and for that reason you thought you would write about the manned space program.
Well, yeah, that's right. I was a child of the space program myself. I was born in 1955. I grew up in San Diego. My father worked for General Dynamics, making many of the rockets for NASA. As I say in the book, I wanted to do something, write something that would be uplifting. The bomb is a terribly depressing subject. What then happened, and I think it's one of those classic stories, it's why we historians work in the trade we do, is I found a subject that was riddled by myth, and that wasn't quite the picture I remembered from the 1960s. It wasn't all the adventure and the new frontiers. That actually the dominant personalities were a lot of people who were pushing the space program for ulterior motives. Not all of them, but a great number of them, what I call a gang of cynics, manipulators, and demagogues, who were all trying, for their rather selfish purposes, to push America toward the moon, and in effect to pull the wool over American eyes. And so in that process, I found myself, in effect, at a crucial moment where I had to decide, and this was actually after having signed a contract to publish a positive space-oriented book, to instead you know, out of conscience, produce a book which looked at, as the title suggests, the dark side of the moon.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that the program was a big driver for the program was the Cold War and was the desire to compete with the Soviet Union and to demonstrate that the United States was technologically and perhaps in other ways as well superior to the Soviet Union. Would it be going too far to say that if there had been no Cold War, there would have been no manned space program as we know it?
Well, I think that's probably true. Yes, I think we have to remember that for the first, say, 8 years of what we call the space age, from Sputnik in 1957 to around about 1965, all of the major achievements are achieved first by the Russians, and that creates a terrific challenge for the American people in the Cold War, because that is not what the Americans, what the Russians are supposed to be able to do. We were all taught back then that these were two competing systems, but that capitalism was always supposed to deliver the best technology. And that one of the reasons why America was great was that because in the free enterprise system, she would produce the best science. Now, what we now know is that America was producing the best science and the best technology during this period, but that what the Russians were doing was rather cleverly exploiting certain needs that they did have. For instance, the ability to produce very powerful rockets, which could shoot heavy objects into the sky. It's not a particularly In effect, it's a rather crude achievement, but at the time it looked very important. And so I think that desire to catch up with the Russians is what fuels it and pushes it forward. And because the Russians are perceived to be ahead, America sets itself a challenge, which it hopes it can win, which is the idea of manned space travel and the ultimate goal of the moon. I think without that, space would have been much more pragmatic, much more goal-oriented, and it would have been the kinds of things that would have occurred were those things which were directly attached to some benefit back on Earth, such as spy satellites, communication satellites, these kinds of things which are occurring in the background but not getting quite the attention of manned space.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth pointing out, I think, as you do in the book, that at the point where John Kennedy proposed the United States sending a man to the moon, that actually, at that point, the United States had not only caught up to the Soviet Union, it had passed the Soviet Union in terms of its involvement in space. So at that point, he might not have come right out and said it, but at that point, we actually were ahead of the Soviet Union.
Well, indeed. If you look at what the Americans were achieving in 1961, 1962, in the ability to put very sophisticated satellites, weather satellites, communication satellites, the kinds of things that really count in terms of benefits back on Earth, into the air, America was at least 5 years ahead of the Soviets. But because the Soviets were so cleverly and really because of their masters of propaganda determining the standards in the space race, and those standards were oriented toward manned space travel, it appeared that the Americans were behind. And the other thing I think that's worth bearing in mind is that Kennedy, perhaps, but Eisenhower in particular, so much of what was going on in space was so secret that they couldn't even reveal to the American people at that time the leads that they did have, because if they were to do so, they would also be making some revelations which they didn't want the Russians to know about. And so those kinds of... the White House, the presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy were put in a rather difficult position of actually not being able to tell the American people, or not being able to explain to them in ways they could understand that they were actually ahead.
I just also want to make sure that people understand your thinking about this. You can tell me precisely, but I don't believe that you would necessarily argue against any kind of scientific exploration of space. You're not saying something like that.
No, not at all. I think if we look at this, one of the things we forget about the whole space age is that the most articulate and determined opposition to it was voiced at the time by scientists who were saying that this isn't about science. This is simply a rather shallow and pointless race with the Soviets, simply because the Soviets have determined that what is really important is being able to stuff a man inside a space capsule and bring him back to Earth. The scientists were arguing at the time that most of the really meaningful things that could be achieved out in space could be achieved much more cost effectively without involving man. And so I think that's one of the great tragedies of the 60s, is that in the process of so much effort and particularly so much money being put into manned space travel, the really meaningful stuff that could be achieved in space was put on the back burner at great loss. I think, you know, it's difficult to talk about what ifs, but if that kind of money had been invested very early into the truly scientific effort of space exploration, where would we be now?
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Gerard Groot. He's professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He's written quite a lot on various aspects of 20th century history. He has a new book out, just came out last fall, that's titled Dark Side of the Moon, The Magnificent Madness of the American Lunar Quest, and it is published by the New York University Press. Questions from people listening are certainly welcome, and we have one ready to go in Urbana, so let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
I happen to be a space scientist and so on and so forth, but I was wondering, first of all, since you have him on the phone, how many golf balls are we going to stick into space? Starting with St. Andrews and so on and so forth, because I had a son that was majoring in golf over there. I think that's the only place that he ever was able to put them. My related question, since I read your book and so forth, and I totally agree with it, is how much money have we wasted? And like you said, we're kind of stuck on this planet, aren't we?
I'm not quite sure about the golf ball thing, and it is it's an unfortunate.
Somebody sent billions of dollars to shoot a golf ball off the space station or something.
Yes. In fact, I see where you are. Yes, it was in fact a criticism that was made way back when in the television program All in the Family by the son Meathead, who said, yeah, you know, why are we spending billions of dollars to allow Alan Shepard to hit a golf ball on the moon. Originally, when I was writing the book, I suggested that they actually put a picture of Alan Shepard hitting the golf ball, because it did seem to me to show in effect encapsulate the farce of that aspect of the program. Unfortunately, the Shepard estate wouldn't allow me to use the photo. How much money was it? It was, by various counting, it was about $35 billion, which at the time, if you figure roughly there were 180 million people in America, that's about $2,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. Now, the interesting thing is I grew up in a family of five children, so there was seven of us. That would have been $14,000, which was about twice what my, about 2 years of my father's income. It's a huge sum, and it's also a huge sum when you consider what else it could have been spent on. When I talked earlier about the scientists being the ones that opposed it, that they were full of many wonderful things, including establishing new universities and science foundations, and using that money on purposes back on Earth.
You could almost build a children for schools or something with what it costs to...
Well, that's what they were saying. Yes, you could establish 100 new universities back then in America. Or
yeah.
you could give... They were also saying that you could have given every school teacher in America a 10% rise in salary. Yeah.
Hmm. Anyhow, I loved your book, and I actually read it, and so on and so forth, and I've referred it to friends.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And, you know, have fun with it, but I just think it's hilarious. I don't know what we're going to do next. I guess.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the things that I wanted to do with this book was to expose what politicians can do, and I think it has a relevance for today because I fear that this same argument is being used again today with the new villain being China in space rather than the Russians in space, and I think we need to watch out for this and question where and why all this money is being spent.
Oh, and the other thing when it comes to space science and so forth is all those little golf balls are going to start falling back on us at some point.
Well, yeah, that's a possibility,
or at
too.
Or with spaceships or something. They're going to be really heavy, and they're going to hurt us.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, anyhow, I didn't mean to annoy you and so forth, but I really liked your book. So
thank you. No, I didn't understand the golf reference at first, but that's fine.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call.
Yeah.
Would you, Professor DeGroote, I think that one of the things that you point out in your book is that, in fact, that human beings dreamed about traveling in space and wrote stories about it, certainly long before the Cold War. Given our penchant for exploration, some people might argue that there's a certain inevitability about our desire to put a person on the moon and for the rest of us to see a person standing on the moon.
Well, I think so. I think that we have this tendency to equate achievement that it has to involve living, breathing human beings, and therefore, you know, in effect, what happened was in the 1960s, we were at this period where we had convinced ourselves that there were no frontiers left on Earth, and therefore that the only frontiers were out there in space, and it only made sense. In a spiritual sense, if those frontiers were explored by real humans. I think the other thing, if you mentioned about the early people that wrote about space and fantasized about space, there's something to this idea that gravity isn't just a physical force, that it's also a spiritual force, in the sense that it doesn't just hold man to the earth, but it also restrains his spirit, his imagination, and that therefore, in order to that out in space, man can discover a more perfect world, and that man can also discover his own inner purity, and that's the way a lot of this early science fiction is written. This fantasizing of creating a better world outside the Earth, and so that's a big driving inspiration for the early space pioneers, this idea that you can escape from the almost sort of corrupting influence of Earth out in space.
Mm-hmm. And I think here, just again to underscore the point that you made, I think your argument here is that the people who were indeed the pioneers in this effort recognized that it would be easier to build public support for the effort if people were involved, that they could have built unmanned exploratory craft and gone to the moon or to Venus or to Mars or to any place else, but it would never have had the impact that it had when you, as you say, when you took a person and you stuffed them into this tin can that you stuck on top of the rocket, or it certainly wouldn't have the impact of seeing a human being standing on the surface of the moon.
Precisely. It's the sort of, space has to have a face. A robot can't be a hero. The minute you stuff a man in a space capsule, he automatically becomes a hero, even if early in the space program, these men weren't really piloting their craft. It certainly is a massive influence upon the public's willingness to fund the space adventure, the fact that men are actually out in space, because it's a way, I think, for the public to sort of vicariously live out their own heroic fantasies. But in so doing, it's also very limiting. You mentioned Venus. It's pretty much incomprehensible for a man to go travel to Venus because of of how inhospitable the environment is. Yet a robotic craft could land on Venus. The other problem, I think, with man in space is the minute you put a man into a space capsule, that mission has to become a return trip. So it limits how far you can go. It also means that you have to make the capsule like a home. It has to have breathable air. It has to have a toilet. It has to have a constant supply of fresh water. So all of these things increase the complexity, increase the cost, of course, and limit how far you can go. And I think that's probably been proved most graphically by the various Explorer and Voyager satellites have gone out to the far reaches of the solar system, things that man could never even contemplate doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have several callers. In fact, the lines are full, and I promise these people I'll get right to them. Just sort of asking one further question. I suppose there were some people who would argue, though, that all of the things that we have talked about, the kind of technologies that were developed, heavy launch vehicles and capsules that would keep the astronauts alive, and a kind of technology, spacesuits and everything that would allow them to survive in space and on the surface of the moon, but those are the kinds of things that if we were ever going to contemplate the idea of sending a human into space, those are technological challenges that we would have had to solve at some point. So is it really the case that we learned nothing from all of this?
No, I think we did. We did learn some things. As some people have said, we learned how to turn urine back into water again. But you have to ask whether those things are necessarily, useful back on Earth. What kind of return are you getting for that kind of investment? And whether, in fact, the technologies that you're creating to solve the problems are problems which needn't have existed if not for the fact that you had decided to put man in space in the first place.
Our guest is Gerard de Groot. He is professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He is the author of the book Dark Side of the Moon, The Magnificent Madness of the American Lunar Quest. It was published in November, and it's published by the New York University Press. And we have several callers here, so we'll get right to them and get back to it with someone here in Champaign County, where we are. This is Line 2. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Just a moment. All tangled up in wires with this new system here. I'm looking at, you've gone through the whole half hour, and I understand you earlier wrote a book about nuclear weapons. There's a book from 84 by Jack Mano of the Syracuse Peace Community called Arming the Heavens, The Hidden Military Agenda for Space, 1945 to 1995.
Yeah.
I believe, are you familiar with his work?
Yes, I've heard of it, yeah.
Well, I think you should look at it. It's available $1.95 in paperback from from Amazon.
Right.
It covers this ideation about how space was going to be, you know, well, full spectrum dominance is back in vogue, and this rods of God ideation, idea of what they would call a passive weapon. What's the expression they use for that? I don't know. Momentum weapon, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He goes through the history, and I think the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists actually printed a short essay by him some years ago about how the shuttle was actually upsized from its earlier incarnation as the dinosaur X-23 or something. Because of the idea it was going to be a rapid deployment. Now, it doesn't have to really be a reasonable thing if people were believing that it would work for them. I just think there's a whole agenda here, dual use. You know, if you're spending a lot of money with Lockheed Martin, they don't mind too much whether it's just another way to fuel the military industrial complex to a large extent.
Well, exactly, and it's very interesting to see the way these ideas came about. I mean, virtually within months of Sputnik being shot into space. The RAND Corporation and the U.S. Army was coming out with ideas for how they would make use of space, and these included the creation of vast permanent settlements on the moon, which were all designed for the deployment of nuclear weapons from space. The other person who really made use of this was Lyndon Johnson. Virtually immediately, he came out with his catchphrase, which was that, if we don't do something about the Russians, before long they're going to be shooting missiles down at us from space like kids dropping rocks from freeway overpasses. And this was something which he virtually, went around the country stoking up American fears. Now, what no one ever really quite pointed out was what the purpose of this all would be in terms of having weapons in space. The nuclear weapons are either supposed to be aggressive or defensive, and yet no one could actually point out how putting them in space made them either more efficient aggressively or defensively, and yet it was an idea which existed and was eventually, of course, even taken up by Ronald Reagan with his Star Wars idea.
I really think it's an important dimension, and I could say I think this Jack Mano book is, even though it was printed in 1984, a good year for it, actually.
Yeah.
It covers 45 to 95, and I'm all for space exploration, but your argument is very persuasive, and we still hear that today, too, a recurring theme that if we weren't spending as much money improving the system such that they have to be completely redundant for human transport, that we could be sending a lot more. And this Mars venture seems to be, to my mind, a cover for another agenda as well.
Well, indeed, and the situation is really so similar to the 1960s. I mean, battled presidency, an unpopular war, and a president who therefore turns to space as the creation of a new adventure story, something Americans can feel good about. I think we have to ask questions about that.
So your reaction, that is your reaction to the kind of talk that we have heard here fairly recently, that the United States should move to establish a permanent base on the moon and should set as a goal putting a person on Mars. You think that it's essentially that's the same, the real backstory is much the same backstory as it was in 1961?
Well, I think it has, for me, there's distinct echoes from the 1960s. What particularly, you can find many similarities, some of which are real, some of which are perhaps forced, but what particularly strikes me is the way this, in the same way as back in the 1960s. Neither President Bush or NASA have actually explained what it's actually for. In the same way that Kennedy in 1960, when he said we should put Americans on the moon and bring them back, never actually explained what it was for beyond getting a jump on the Russians. There was vague talk about, you know, pushing forward frontiers of science, etc. But when it actually came down to it, there was nothing, no explanation of what it would actually bring. In terms of an improvement to the life of the American people, perhaps not in such a chauvinistic sense, the life of people back on Earth. Mm-hmm. And surely, if you do something out in space, it has to be to improve life back on Earth in some way. And in the same way that explorers, you know, back in the 1600s or the 15th century. They went looking for something, and they found things. They found things that were profitable. New businesses could come forward. Commerce was pushed forward. That sort of explanation that has always throughout history has been what drives exploration forward. But in this sense, what is the actual profit to be gained from that kind of exploration? And that hasn't, I think, yet been sufficiently explained.
Yeah.
Aside from certain vague, very vague references to perhaps new energy sources to be found on the moon, etc. But I think one thing we have to bear in mind is that if, for instance, let's suppose that they went to Mars today, in 20 years' time, and they found on the surface diamonds, perfect, wonderful diamonds. If they picked up all those diamonds and brought them back to Earth, it still wouldn't be profitable. It's that kind of expense. So you have to find something which actually has a cost-benefit worth, and I haven't heard yet what it is. And that's the question that keeps getting evaded.
Well, let's talk with somebody else here. Someone in Farina, Illinois, or perhaps Farina, probably. Line number 4, our toll-free line.
Yeah. Hi.
Hello, yes.
Yeah, they call it Farina. I've always called it Farina. I've always been a big supporter of the space program. I think it's one of the sanest things that the U.S. government has done in historical times, and especially when you compare the $30 billion a year black budget and the $450 billion that's proposed for the next year for the Pentagon. I mean, okay, what's it for? The space program in historic times was helped in a hope for new lives in the future, and to call it shallow and pointless, I mean, who are those scientists? And to say that the people that support the space program were cynics, manipulators, demigods, it makes me question you as a master of propaganda. I mean, give me a break. What about the billions they threw away in Vietnam and the lives and so forth? And on top of all this, I want you to make a comment on Nixon's cancellation of the last three moon landings. And one last thing, there's a company named Bigelow Aerospace is proposing a space hotel that could orbit the Earth and then actually take a translunar trip with the entire hotel. And tell me that's not hopeful. Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Well, I expect that that some of the points that the caller raised you would actually agree with.
Well, I would. I mean, I don't. I would never propose that. It was an alternative between fighting in Vietnam or going to the moon. I was opposed to both of them. I still think both of those ventures were pointless. I think your caller is absolutely right. Billions are wasted by the Pentagon. That doesn't mean we should waste billions in space, however. All I'm saying is it seems to me that it was a very expensive adventure, which didn't get us much in the long term. Yes, gave the American people a huge sense of pride, but $35 billion is a lot to pay for the Americans to feel proud of themselves. Interestingly, and this relates to the Vietnam question, we all think that that the space program was immensely popular, and that Apollo was every launch of Apollo was greeted by the American people with a great sense of celebration. But deep in the NASA files, NASA paid a huge amount of attention to public opinion. Deep in the NASA files is a virtually complete set of all of the opinion polls taken by the various opinion poll organizations during the 1960s, which asked the question, is it worth the money? At only one time during the 1960s, and that was after the Christmas orbit of the moon in 1968, did a majority of American people tell the polling organizations that, yes, it was worth the money, all that money was well spent. Now, what's interesting about that in relation to Vietnam, and again, not many people realize this, is that that suggests that for most of the 1960s, the Vietnam War was more popular than the space program. That in turn, when the American people were asked, is this venture worth the money? Up until the Tet Offensive, most Americans would say, yes, the Vietnam War was worth the money. They didn't say the same thing when they were asked about the space program. And that's why NASA had to spend so much of its huge budget on public relations, because actually the American people weren't in favor of it. They celebrated the achievements, but when they were asked whether it was worth the money, they usually said no.
Hmm. And again, I guess I want to underscore something we discussed a little earlier in the program for anybody who might have tuned in, just to make sure that people understand where you're coming from. You're not saying that we shouldn't be spending money on exploration of space.
No, not at all.
Your point was that it was that there was really that here we spent a lot of money to do something that had maybe symbolic significance, but practically there was no real good reason to do it other than we could say that we had done it.
Yes, ironically, the most important achievements in space, in terms of the benefit back on Earth, or also in terms of actual exploration, were those that were achieved by those programs which during the 1960s were starved of cash. Starved of cash because most of the money was going into the manned space program. If we think about what has space given us? It has given us enormous benefits in terms of being able to predict weather, being able to find where we are with, global positioning mechanisms, etc. All of these kinds of things are wonderful achievements, but ironically, they all resulted from a program which was constantly having to fight for money because most of the money was going on this, what I call an attempt to kick lunar dust in Soviet faces.
Hmm. There were a half a dozen successful landings. There were a couple of others that had been planned, and I think the caller made reference to the fact that they were canceled.
Yeah.
And I suppose one of the questions about it all was, and I guess perhaps it goes to this question, what is it for? The fact that after a handful of men actually walked on the moon, then it just stopped. There wasn't anything else, which perhaps suggests that there really was no there was no further goal other than putting a person on the moon. There was nothing else to do after that, apparently.
Precisely. The fact that the space program, as we know it, the idea of exploration ended so abruptly, I think demonstrates that it was a single goal-oriented expedition. It was all geared towards simply showing the Russians that the Americans could land on the moon before the Russians could. Now, once you achieved that, there wasn't a lot of point in doing it any more times. The fact that the last few planned Apollo missions were canceled, and were canceled with virtually no public outcry at all. I think one of the interesting things is that the, for instance, the last Apollo mission to the moon was hardly even televised because the major networks didn't really want to have anything to do with it. It was just old news. Americans had lost interest in it. So it is, you know, it is simply the job was done, been there, done that. Let's move on to something else. I think demonstrates that there was really no long-term purpose in this venture. And that's, I think, what made the scientists so angry. And to go back to what your caller said about these scientists, these were Nobel Prize winners. These weren't just ordinary, you know, people calling themselves scientists at podunk universities. These were people who really saw that that the wool was being pulled over American eyes, that this wasn't a venture having anything to do with scientific exploration. This was simply a propaganda exercise.
Our guest is Gerard de Groot. He's professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and he is the author of 10 books on various aspects of 20th century history. His most recent, before the one we're talking about here, was a book about the development of nuclear weapons. That book was The Bomb a Life, and it won the Westminster Medal for the best book on war or military topic that year. I think that was 2004. Also, his new book, the one we're talking about here this morning, is Dark Side of the Moon, The Magnificent Madness of the American Lunar Quest, and it is published by New York University Press. We have one more caller here. I want to make sure that we accommodate before we run out of time. The caller is in Spring Bay and line one. Hello.
That's good morning.
Yeah.
Hello.
I completely agree with all of the points you've been making, and I'm so excited to hear that you've written a book about this. I don't know how long ago it was when we started to hear about the mission to Mars and the permanent moon and you know, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing, these supposedly unemotional, logical scientists and engineers talking like 12-year-old kids about how great it was going to be. And I was thinking to myself that we really need to put our best scientific minds to work on figuring out how we're going to live on this planet in the next 50 years. And this gee whiz kind of cowboy thing of sending men and women, you know, humans out into space is really old thinking. And we got to start looking at doing it through robots and sensors and all the rest. So I was just really thrilled to hear what you're saying this morning, and glad you're, you know, bringing this into the discussion. I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Well, thank you very much. It's a book which attacks, I think, a sacred American myth. And for that reason, I have to confess, I've actually received quite a bit of hate mail. So it's actually quite enlivening, I think, to have someone like you say, you know, that this resonates with what you were thinking. It's very interesting. It was not long after Neil Armstrong actually walked on the moon that an American theologian said that the problem with the American people is that they equate progress with movement, and that therefore, because they've explored the Earth, there's nowhere further to move on Earth physically. They have to go out in space in order to give them the sense that they are a dynamic people. And he was saying that what we need to do is see progress in a much more spiritual sense. Why can't we see frontiers as something which still exists on Earth? frontiers like poverty, medical problems, man's propensity to fight wars with each other. Why are these simply seen as problems, whereas frontiers only exist out in space? He expressed it a lot more lyrically and eloquently than I have right now. But it was really a very beautiful summing up of a human predicament. And particularly, I think it is, and I can say this because I'm an American, it is an American predicament. It's very interesting to see how that traditional American frontier sense, which drove them across the American continent, ends up getting so easily translated into a sort of manifest destiny to go to the moon.
I guess, though, that there would be, there's still going to be people like not this last caller, but the one before, that would continue to see that impulse as something positive, as the aspiring to do something that might on the face of it seem crazy or nearly impossible, like taking a human being and sending him from the Earth to the moon and bringing him back, that does reflect or encourage a kind of outward-looking, seeking, positive optimism. That's not such a bad. That not only is it not such a bad thing, but that's a natural part of the human spirit.
I would agree completely, and I think that has been what has been driving it forward. What I find unfortunate is the way that that sort of quest for dynamism, that desire to do something new and to explore, has been manipulated by people who, for various reasons, have wanted to cash in on it or to use it for their own somewhat cynical political purposes. I think one of the hardest things for me, a person who grew up in the 1960s, was to come across a never before published tape of a conversation, White House conversation, between John Kennedy and James Webb, in which Kennedy, James Webb being the NASA administrator, in which Kennedy says, "I do not care about the moon. All I care about is beating the Russians," and saying, basically telling Webb, "All I want you to do is get us to the moon, and then we can forget about it." And when it's the person that we, so many of us admired back then as embodying that very sort of thrusting spirit that you're talking about, expresses something in that cynical of terms, then it does leave a very bad taste in your mouth. And you get a sense of the way we've all been manipulated.
Mm. We're unfortunately down to the point where we have about a minute or two left. And so I hesitate to launch into such a question, but were there other people that didn't perhaps have political agendas, but had other kinds of agendas and then used this desire to have this achievement or perhaps to show up the Russians simply because it gave them an opportunity to do what they wanted to do?
Well, yes, and I think that's all lies in the title. I the reason I called it Magnificent Madness is because I think there were a lot of elements of it which were absolutely magnificent. That's one of the sad parts of the story. I have great admiration for the bravery and creativity of the astronauts themselves. They were genuine explorers. And I still get shivers down my spine when I watch Apollo 13 and see an example of human ingenuity at its best. And I don't think that we should throw out the baby with the bathwater. This sort of spirit exists in human beings, and so much of what occurred in the Apollo program embodies that spirit. I just wish it had been directed in a way which was more genuine, for one thing, and also perhaps in a long-term sense, more profitable to the human condition back on Earth.
Yeah. Well, at that, we will have to finish because we're here at the end of the time. If you'd like to read more on this subject, get more of our guest thoughts, you look for the book. It's titled Dark Side of the Moon, The Magnificent Madness of the American Lunar Quest. It's published by the New York University Press by our guest Gerard de Groot. He's professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And he's speaking to us from there. Professor de Groot, thanks very much.
Thank you.